Hello and welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, where we discuss the interesting political issues of the moment. I'm Mike Siluma and thank you for joining us. Now, recently, former public protector and leading social justice activist, Professor Tulu Madonsela, said the cat among the pigeons with a post on her X account suggesting that racial supremacists among us need to be helped to heal from their post-transformation trauma. We invited Professor Madonsela to elaborate on her proposition, and she has kindly agreed.
I will not renew my membership of the EFF. I also request to resign all positions in the EFF.
We are not going to have a parallel government run by Helen Zille. There's one president here, and that president is Cyril Ramaphosa.
Bavas J.
Marikana.
Honourable members, be in order.
Those who are involved in state capture, action will be taken.
Does that include the top seven?
No.
Why does it not?
Don't start trouble. Nobody's going to announce tomorrow. The results are not correct. If that happens, people will be provoking.
You're dealing with Jacob Zuma. Every stage is a theatre for him.
The people of Palestine, they're denied the right to enjoy the freedoms we so love.
Who are blown but not out.
Welcome again to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, Prof.
Thank you for the privilege, Mike. It's an honor to be part of this.
Yes, but before we go far, let's go over part of your post on X, and then we can proceed from there. Now, you said one of the realities that needs addressing in our lifetime is a need for people who were raised to believe they were superior to heal from the trauma and grief of discovering the truth that they actually are equal to all others, including those they were raised to think they were superior to. Now, what I found it very intriguing, you know, that you would actually take the trouble to post a sentiment like that. What prompted you? What did you see? What did you observe, you know, to get to the point where you actually expressed the view publicly?
There were several prompters to me expressing that. But even before I expressed that, via Twitter. It's something I had shared with some of the communities that I speak to on social justice and ethics. But I would say there were two prompters in that week. One is obviously the people who come to my timeline and attack me, and they tell me that they thought I was clever and they supported me and they discovered I'm not. And I read that to be suggesting that when they think I'm tolerant of racist views, then they think I'm clever. When I am not tolerant of those views, then I'm suddenly not clever. Firstly, I don't even like that kind of classification. But the second one is really the situation in Palestine, that if you look at it properly, the average Zionist was raised to believe that they are superior. Of course, theirs is couched in religious superiority. But given the fact that Palestinians are brown and Israelis are primarily white, there is an issue of race there. People have been raised to believe they're superior, having to accept that they've been traumatized by the truth of our time, and an opportunity to grieve that and then transcend it. So it's not just always about race, though. It's about gender. Just anybody who was raised to believe that just because they look a particular way, they deserve more than others. In a society that is based on human rights, social justice, and the acceptance of equality between all human beings, to them it feels like loss of a right as opposed to loss of an unmerited privilege.
If we look at you making the example of the Palestinian question, but also I suspect you're also talking about us here, you know, maybe primarily about us here.
Yes.
To say that, why should, I mean, you're saying that they've got the former oppressors or the people who thought they were superior, i.e. in our context, it's the white people, really, you know, to simplify it. Now, you are saying that they've got grief and they've got trauma. Now, it's a very difficult for most people. It would be very difficult to understand, to embrace the concept that people who were in the wrong are now coming, you know, are now being described as needing almost sympathy and help for the trauma that they suffered. Someone might say, what is the trauma that they've suffered? You know, where does this trauma come from? This grief, what are they grieving over?
When you assist people to overcome trauma, not because you are requesting sympathy for them per se, although empathy is important, but you help people to heal so that they cannot harm others. Hurt people hurt others. And if you're not going to help people to acknowledge their trauma, to acknowledge their woundedness, they'll continue to wound others. And that's not fishing for sympathy for them. We do that with men. We talk about toxic masculinities. We talk about male fragility. We talk about masculine displacement. When men have been raised, you're the provider, you're in charge, and they come into the world where women are in charge of some of the spaces they have to occupy, and sometimes they're not the provider. And there's a whole lot of work that is being done to help men to understand that the privilege you had was unmerited to start with. It was founded on injustice. So what has been taken away was not yours to start with. But that said, it does feel like a loss because your expectations have not been met. And then you need a bridge into this new life where everyone is equal. I don't think it's being kinder to white than you are to black people. It's being realistic about the need for people to grieve their loss so that they can transcend what they consider to be a loss.
Mm. So the question would be, you know, if we were to do that, to have the empathy, as you put it, to help white people deal with their grief and their trauma, who's going to do that? Whose responsibility is it to do that?
That's a very good question, my brother. It's white people. In some of these spaces, I've said white people should not come and teach people, black people, how to deal with their trauma, because that's like asking a man to come and teach women how to understand their generational trauma and to transcend it. It's not going to work because you'll make wrong assumptions and you'll never understand how it feels anyway to be a victim of discrimination, including residual discrimination. So for white people, I think white people should help other white people to understand that the loss is not really a loss as such, but it is, of course, changed expectations. It's basically the situation such as in the book Who Moved My Cheese, where these people, they have this cheese all the time. They don't know who put that cheese there. But one day, two humans and two mice rock up and they find there's no cheese anymore. Yes, the cheese was disappearing gradually, but they didn't realize that. And I think for a whole lot of supremacists, the reality of racism being unjust and racism having no place in civilized society has been there since the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. But even before then, the Treaty of Versailles had already said injustice has no place in a civilized world where we want social cohesion and peace. So the cheese has been moving over time. But when it then moves abruptly, there is a sense of loss. Because if you are raised to believe that's your cheese, when it's gone, you do grieve. You do feel a sense of loss.
Even if it was an unjust cheat.
So I think somebody should gently help them. Pardon?
Even if it was an unjustly acquired cheese.
Absolutely. I think it's not a matter of justice. It's a matter of pragmatism. That in the same way, for example, people like Sonke Gender Justice, they help men to understand that it was never right that as a man, you are said to be the head of the family, that the women have to respect you, but you have no duty to respect, that the relationships should have been reciprocal from the very outset. And you never had a right to beat anyone for not agreeing with you. So they take them through that. That doesn't mean they don't acknowledge that gender supremacy or male supremacy is wrong. They accept that male supremacy is wrong, but they also accept that we are the product of all of the neural pathways that have developed in our heads. Covey calls it paradigms, all of the mind maps that we have in our heads because of the books we read, the churches we attended, the stories we read, the families we grew in told us, white people were told you're superior, black people were told you are you're second class citizens. I mean, this conversation has to go into even black people understanding that it's good to be black as it is good to be white. Mm. Because we're still in that generational bridge where if your parents were educated, chances are they were what we call in Zulu, amazamtiti. So I don't come from a amazamtiti family. And my view of life is slightly different. But people come from amazamtiti families. They were raised to believe that blackness has stigma because of the requirement during colonialism even, that if you wanted to be treated as a normal human being, you had to apply to be exempted from being treated as a native and sort of apply to be treated as an honorary white, then you'd be treated properly. But that would mean then you have to do things that show that you have been properly assimilated, dress in a particular way. I once was a professional witness, actually, an expert witness in a case of customary law. I had to argue that this family had been Europeanized because their child had a godmother and a godfather and just generally lived in a Western way, and therefore they were not subject to customary law. But that also meant whites understood themselves to be the gold standard, and everyone else had to follow into that. And then you get the Group Areas Act that stigmatizes blackness. You get courts that condemned blackness. And all of that fed into a paradigm that says white is superior, black is inferior, and to be recognized as a civilized human being, you have to behave in a white way.
Mm. So you're saying that even black people, the consciousness of black people will need to be looked at in terms of rejecting the old paradigms, racial paradigms.
Absolutely. I think that's something that Steve Biko, the Black Consciousness Movement, if it's understood in its proper context, it wasn't arguing for black supremacy. It was just arguing for a human consciousness. In fact, I even prefer the earlier version, the Pixlikasemi people that were looking at Ubuntu way of looking at life. Is that, yes, black people too have to transcend that. A lot of it, though, is unconscious and subconscious. So nobody wakes up, or good white people don't wake up and say, I'm going to feel myself to be superior to black people. Only the Teplanches of this world are like that. And good, the normal black people don't walk around thinking whatever is white is better. Same thing applies to men. These are records that are playing subconsciously. This is software in our headspace that we're not even conscious of. But you'll see this playing out in terms of who do you choose to do certain things, because consciously, who do you believe? Who gets grieved in our newspapers when they're dead in numbers? Who doesn't get grieved?
Okay. Now, just to go to the because you seem to be casting this as a national problem. For example, there's work to be done on the white side, but also there's work to be done on the black side in order for all of us to get to a particular place where of equality and mutual recognition of each other, of each other's humanity. But someone might say, how can we even have empathy to the situation of white people when so many of them are denialist about even what has happened? They're denying what has happened, and they are denying what is happening today, the inequalities of today. You know, if I was looking at your, there's some of the responses to your post. I mean, some people are saying that they were talking about the med school entrance, implying that black people are allowed to get into med school with a 30% pass. Others were saying you're being un-Christian in the things you're saying, you're stirring racial hatred, etc. There seems to me to be a lot of imperviousness to any attempt to reach out and raise issues that are of importance to black people. So how do we get to a point of empathy and even sympathy or understanding for people like that?
Well, empathy does not mean there's no accountability, but all of that, what we've said is true. I was with I had lunch yesterday with a colleague, a white colleague from the art industry, performance arts, and she does, she researches this thing. And she took issue with me the very same way that you're taking issue, that she's worried that that kind of approach might even encourage people to be more unrepentant about their racism. I don't think so. The truth is, it's an elephant in the room. The truth is, it harms both us and white people, because a lot of them are perpetually angry. And they're angry because they feel something they deserve has been unjustly taken away. And it becomes even worse when you deal with restitutive action, because there hasn't been conversations around how the past still defines the present. So a whole lot of them see restitution as punishment. So for me, I think for everyone's sake, in the same way that when it comes to gender, we say we need to do male work or men work, we have to do white work. And I think white people have to do white work, but we also have to engage with, I personally do engage with people. And it's okay to say, I feel displaced. I was raised to think that I was going to be the next person in charge. I remember a colleague telling me that before democracy, he had worked hard and he was going to be the branch manager. He had sort of had gotten those kinds of indicators that if you work hard enough, you are going to be the next one. And then when the appointment came, they appointed a black person, and the manager, the outgoing manager, explained to him that it is what we need to do to redress the consequences of the past. And he said then he was so hurt, he left. But he now understands that those consequences of the past need to be redressed, because if they're not redressed, they will get worse.
But still, Prof, someone might say, What have white people actually lost? Because if we look at the statistics in our country, they are still the economic top dogs. Their wealth is still sitting, you know, overwhelmingly with white people. They live in the best neighborhoods. You know, they really are living the good life. So someone might say, what exactly are they angry about? What have they lost?
You see, that's exactly the engagement. If somebody engages with them, you would confront them with those figures, that the fact that white poverty is worse than black poverty is not true. Only 1% of people in the white community are poor, whereas among black people, just before COVID, it was already 64.2. Among Africans, among those classified as colored, it was around 39%. Around classified as Indian, it was around 6%, which are the patterns of colonialism and apartheid. So these conversations would make them understand perception versus reality. In the workplace, they get told that you're not likely to get promoted if you're white. But statistics show that from middle management to senior management, you're more likely to get a promotion in the private sector if you're white. And that senior top management is still 65% white, when white people make less than 8% of the population. So these engagements would get them to understand the truth versus reality. And the second thing, this assumption that because there was Bantu education and the fact that there's been brain stunting because of starvation and malnutrition, then virtually every black person is not good enough to occupy positions of authority or professional positions. All of those are lies. Again, you confront them with truths around since 1994 to now, how many black people have been generated by combined schools? So I think these conversations will help people to understand their perception versus reality, but also to let go of what they think they deserve when they don't deserve it, in the same way that we say that to men. You've got to let go of your male supremacy because it was never used to start with. Ancient societies were not about supremacy. They were about practicality. If you're going to be pregnant, you'd have to do the gathering closer to the homestead. And when agriculture started in Africa, you'd have to do the agriculture because it's closer to the house and looking after children. If you're a man, you're going to go and hunt. And you're going to go to war because somebody has to look after kids, but it had nothing to do with who's superior and who's not superior. So the supremacy thing gets introduced at the start of primarily, at least here, forced capitalism. And I'm not against capitalism here. I'm just saying we get these notions because people want to claim a bigger slice of the benefits of living together. Yet nobody should get a bigger slice simply because biologically God made them a particular way. We all have to get a slice that is proportionate to our contribution, but also balanced with human solidarity for those who really can't do anything because they're old or severely disabled or young.
You just touched in passing on the question of the system that we live under, its role or impact in the problem that we're talking about. Now, I was going to ask you a related question about the role. You know, we were saying that people become what they are socialized to be largely unless they break out of that mold. You know, now I was going to ask you about the role of institutions, for example, our education system, you know, to say after 30 years, how is it that we have got people who graduate from, let's say, white people who graduate from the education system? And there are so many of them who actually deny what has happened or will not accept the need for restitution, etc., or for equality even. You know, between white people and black people. Do you think that our system may be failing somewhere? Our education system may be failing somewhere?
For some of the generations, it failed. If I look at the ages of my children, they're all in their 30s. That generation, the system failed. I remember when my son was doing grade 4 and he still read history that had a paragraph that said when the people were going into the inland, they were faced with many dangers.
Sorry, which people?
Snakes. No, it just had those words. When the people were going into the inland, they were faced with many dangers. Snakes, wild animals, and natives. So this was talking about the Great Trek. Now, I went to the principal. This was Glen Spencer Primary School. I went to the principal and said, where does my son place himself here? He's grade four. And there's the people on the one side and there's the dangerous things on the other side, which is snakes, wild animals, and natives. And his answer was, it's a decision of the governing board. And of course, I moved him to Watercliff Primary School. So I do think that there has to be a process that reviews all the books, because at the moment there is a semi-federalized system in that the governing board decides what little books are going to be used in that school. Those little books have messages around whether we have shared humanity, where no human being has less value, whether they're able-bodied or disabled, whether they're heterosexual or not heterosexual, foreigner and national. They have to just check and make sure that those books do that, number one, but also to make sure that the books tell the history properly. One of the things I picked, though, which made me really happy, is they do now. This current generation, I've heard young people, black and white, coming to interview me about how did apartheid impact on me. And I thought that, what a clever thing by their teachers, because they're doing it like Rwanda now. Instead of always talking about the past in terms of the glorious the glorious heroes of the struggle, they're looking at ordinary people and say, as an ordinary person, how did apartheid impact you? What did it take away from you? Where would you be now? I was shocked when I was interviewed by these little ones. The only thing I would say is missing there is that they start the problem in 1948, and therefore it seems like it was just a few years, and therefore we can fix the problem. They don't start the problem with colonialism. And for me, it's not even the wars of conquest. I start the talk from the moment the law after elections was abused to entrench white supremacy, and that starts in the Cape in 1884 with the passing of the Glen Grey Act. So that has nothing to do with conquest. That has something to do with an elected group having suppressed black voting by attaching electoral rights to property ownership. And then, of course, then they then got better numbers. This was before the removal of the right to vote from blacks. Here I'm talking generically black. So the only thing I would say, they need to add to that, but they do teach. That's why there's so much empathy among the young ones. One of my friends here had her daughter at the age of eight write a book, Lola, the Spy Dog, and decide that she was going to donate some of the proceeds to Action for Inclusion, which is something that we're doing with student fees, those who get discontinued because they can't pay fees. And she donated some of it to the Trek for Mandela, caring for girls who can't afford pets. So I honestly think, and I was at the collegiate girls, they had a panel. This is high school. They had a panel on social justice where those young people had a better understanding of social justice than grown-ups I had heard contesting for party leadership in one country abroad. So I think they are doing something, and they're doing it gentle. The idea is not to say to people, you did apartheid. If you are in your 50s right now or your 40s, you're not likely to have voted during apartheid. Or if you, I mean, you were too young to vote if you are 40 right now. So you are a beneficiary of unjust enrichment, if we were to put it in borrowing that legal concept, which is for contract law. But there was unjust enrichment of white people in terms of land, in terms of job preservation, the Group Areas Act, and all of those things. I mean, even properties at Stellenbosch University, they're dealing with the fact that the colored community was kicked out and the university inherited some of those buildings, like literally a whole school. So it wasn't land that was taken away only. It was people's hard-earned properties as well. So again, let me teach about that. So something's happening. Stellenbosch University, for example, does something that's called visual redress. Or number one, it adopted something called a restitution statement. When we start our events, we have these young people reading the restitution statement and acknowledging what happened in the past and the university's complicity in that past. And then they've done now visual redress. One of our main buildings is now named Crotowa. So if you're a student, you're entering our main admin where the vice chancellor is, it's Crotowa. And of course, it's going to trigger questions. Who's Crotowa now? Why is Crotowa on our building? And then then it becomes a conversation that she was a Khoisan woman who was handed over to the Dutch and who found herself in this very invidious position of knowing now that she understood Dutch, that her people were being looted from through the law, through contracts, not just conquest. Mm-hmm. We're just using interpretation. They were stealing their land.
Mm. I was going to ask you that while there is the change that's happening, that, you know, to some people it might be too slow, overdue. To some people it might be too fast. You know, whichever way one looks at it, I've heard people say that part of the problem, why in particular we continue to have the problem of denialism among white people, is that we don't treat racism with the necessary harshness from a punitive point of view. You know, if you look at a country like Germany, for example, you know, Nazism is completely, you know, untolerated. You know, there are serious consequences for wearing swastikas, for flying Nazi flags, for saying things that are sympathetic to Nazism. Whereas here, you know, the feeling is that you can go to the Human Rights Commission, maybe you get given a diversity training, or maybe a fine. But that's really the totality of the thing. Do you think that that's a fair commentary? In other words, do we need more stick, even as we help people to deal with their grief?
I just don't know whether Germany is less racist because of the harsh approach with which it has treated Nazism, or whether it just went underground. But you are right, though, that there is no loss of face for being racist, especially these days after a president from a particular country emboldened people who are racist. So there's a growing trend of being confidently racist. And you're also right that anti-Semitism and anti-African racism are not treated the same. Anti-African racism is treated mildly. Grow up. Forget about the past. And the past is continuing to mark the present, and it will mark the future as well if it's not arrested. But I think the idea was to firstly build a bridge. I was at an event on doing reconciliation organized by our theology department. So there was nothing wrong in not going the German way. And I remember working with Dalai Omar to look into the process of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And we even went to Germany as part of his entourage. The idea was to build a bridge that would allow some kind of normalcy and an opportunity then to handle these matters in a stable society. And that was done. And I don't necessarily think harsh consequences are necessarily the answer, but a harsh view on racism needs to be restored. I don't think there's loss of face. I don't think racists feel ashamed enough in our society today. I mean, somebody was saying, if we made these things like sexism, racism, as despicable as cannibalism, people would stop them. They would
to put a stigma on them.
If, for example, if they have it embedded, because we are products of a racist society, but if you have it embedded, you would seek help, like an alcoholic would seek help for being an alcoholic.
But Prof, before we round off our conversation, let's talk to and about black people. Now, I'm imagining if white people are grieving and they are suffering trauma, black people are probably suffering even deeper trauma and even deeper grief for some of the issues that you have just mentioned yourself, you know, loss of land, loss of opportunity, which continues even today, you know, just being poor, you know, not having the wealth that other people are enjoying, etc. What do we say to them about their own healing? How do we heal them?
We really do the same and accept that they have suffered trauma and that the trauma is even greater, and that if that trauma is not arrested, it will infect the system generationally. So one of the books that was gifted to me by a total stranger is written, Apartheid, Britain's Bastard Child. It's written by an Afrikaner psychologist, Helen Opperman-Lewis, explaining Afrikaner cruelty and dehumanization of black people in this country, but tracing it back to the English and their own dehumanization of both the Afrikaners and the Africans, and then tracing the English behavior to their dehumanization by Romans. If you've seen the movie Boudica, you will see how Romans were cruel to the English. Mm. And then they went around the world being cruel to people. So I do agree with you that we have to deal with black trauma. But not weaponize that black trauma. It doesn't sit well with me when a white person says they're conducting workshops to help black people to deal with their trauma, because you'll not understand it. Give them money to deal with their own trauma. Mm-hmm. I don't think as a woman I could conduct a workshop to help men to deal with their trauma. And I don't think men can conduct workshops to deal with their trauma. But black people don't just need an acknowledgement of trauma. They need the dislodging of structural inequality. So people should not just acknowledge that black people have been traumatized.
To just say sorry.
We have to acknowledge that we are a deeply unequal society, not because people don't work hard enough, not because people have an entitlement spirit. People have to go to their township to see how hard people work. People have to go into taxi ranks and bus stops and train stations to see how hard people work, how early they leave their homes and get back very late at night to have this attitude that says, oh, spirit of entitlement. Restitution is not a punishment for the past, and it's not a reward for a spirit of entitlement. Restitution is what is necessary to rebalance this country. If that restitution doesn't happen, we will continue to be a deeply unequal society and deeply divided. The thing about inequality and poverty, though, is that they grow exponentially when not arrested. That's why South Africa is the most unequal society in the entire world today, despite our great constitution, despite the investments we've made directly in advancing Black people. But you can't advance Black people through the welfare system where government shares our collective resources with Black people. That's not going to work. There has to be something that comes from the white community. For example, they still own 72% of the land. I heard a minister saying, we are ahead of our target. No, that 30% target was a five-year target. So we still haven't met a five-year target 30 years later. So the idea was to achieve 30% of land redistribution by 2000, and then a new target was going to be set. But it's just not going to work if we don't deal with that. And then people say, oh, not everyone wants to be a farmer. I know a whole lot of people who don't farm, but they live wealthy lives because they've hired out their farms. And your farm is also collateral. Student fees, for example, part of the reason the majority of students, if not virtually all students that struggle with accommodation fees and food are Black, it's because there's no generational wealth. They're coming, they're the first people to go to university. Their parents might be seasonal workers, or one of the parents might earn a little bit more than the 350,000 that NSOS uses as a threshold.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more than one child in that family to be fed with that money. And obviously, then they fall into the missing middle. So to cut the long story short, we do need to deal with Black trauma, but let Black people deal with their trauma. Let women deal with their trauma. Let people with disabilities deal with their trauma. I was at a wonderful event with disabled people, or with people with disabilities at the Artscape. It was them speaking for themselves. And you see, when you speak for yourself, you don't pathologize yourself. You question the system that maintains structural relationships of domination and dispossession. It's the system. You don't pathologize the people. The people you elevate and restore their capabilities to ensure that they operate in a society of equals, as equals.
Okay, all right. Prof. Madonsela, just before we let you go, in the broader sense, there has been a lot of talk, and I'd like to hear your view on this, talk about a national dialogue that's necessary to help us to resolve our national problems. What prospects do you think there are for succeeding in that direction if we have not dealt with the issues that you and I have just been talking about now?
I think that national dialogue is an amazing opportunity to deal with these issues, because the reason we keep talking past each other is because we have different assumptions about what kind of society are we building. And two, we have different assumptions about what kind of society, or what kind of country, if I use Albisex's wording, do we have? And what kind of society does the Constitution want us to build? And that dialogue will deal with those things. And then the starting point of that dialogue would be, what does the Constitution dictate?
You think we should start there?
One of the things we ask people now at an event we had on hunger was, just tell us, do you accept that social justice and human rights, including addressing hunger, is a constitutional responsibility? Two, do you believe that the reason there's hunger is because of unequal power relations in our society, including the consequences of past injustices? Three, which is C, do you commit to do something in your own space to advance social justice? particularly to eliminate hunger, because everyone says the government has not done something. But who creates inequality? Who reproduces inequality? Who creates hunger? It's us human beings in the way we interact with each other, which is something that Eleanor Roosevelt had predicted, that if human rights were going to mean something, they would have to mean something in the little spaces, factories, farms, communities, homes.
Well, Professor Madonsela, I think we're going to have to end our conversation there. I would like us to engage further, closer to the national dialogue process, you know, to talk more about its constitution and who should be in it and who should be driving it, you know, whether it should be, you know, there's one view that says that government must convene it, and there are other people who say no, that might actually constrain the scope of what is going to be discussed there. But I think that is a subject that you and I, you know, when you are available in the near future, we can delve into.
Thank you for the privilege, though, and greetings to the listeners, and hopefully it will take us closer to finding each other halfway.
Yes, no, thank you very much, Prof. Much appreciated. Well, that was Professor Thuli Madonsela, the former public protector, who is currently director of the Center for Social Justice and occupies the Law Trust Research Chair in Social Justice at Stellenbosch University. I'm Mike Siluma. Until next time, be blessed, stay safe, and let's do good for our country.